Hello, this is Atah Durakan with the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, January 6, 2026, coming to you from my home studio, wishing you a very happy new year. And we start today on the front page, Entertainment Eagle Theaters Fade to Black. Cinemas in Clinton, Robinson close as victims of long COVID. It's articles by Olivia Jacobs, Clinton, the Clintonia Eagle Theater in Clinton. The Streeter Eagle 6 in Streeter, and the Eagle Theater in Robinson have closed their doors. The local chain of theaters was started in 2004 by Eric Gubelman. In 2024, the owner shared that the theaters were at risk of closing. And since then, he and others put in their best efforts to ensure that didn't happen, but it wasn't enough. Gubelman announced Sunday the three theaters were closed and their website showed no additional showings scheduled. Other than that, how was the play, Mrs. Lincoln? That's one of those questions, Gubelman said Monday morning of his feelings about the closings. I've got a lot of work to do, you know, cleanup work to keep busy. Yeah, so that's distracting, but we did leave the door open a little bit in our post. Gubelman said the theaters were victims of long COVID and the economic efforts of the pandemic, noting an increase in streaming, disruption of movie supply lines, the politicization of movies, and people spending more time on their couches and smartphones and less time out in their communities. The theater chain's investor had been committed to helping to keep the theaters open by acquiring the buildings and debt, Gubelman said, but the investor's participation and funding were largely dependent upon a project of his own being funded. That project has been delayed repeatedly due to outside circumstances, which made him unable to keep his commitment. When it came to Eagle Theaters, the owner explained, Gubelman announced the closures in Facebook posts for each of the three venues. The post for the Clintonia received more than 75,000 views in and about 12 hours, Gubelman said, with similar numbers for Robinson and Streeter. Community members flooded the comment section, sharing their memories of the theaters, including first dates, engagements, and more. The posts also included a link to a survey asking community members if they would commit to seeing one movie a month at the theater. The owner said the survey received about 700 commitments overnight, but to make a difference, the theaters would have to have 4,500 commitments, or around 1,500 per location. If he had this kind of response a year ago, things may have been a bit different now, Gubelman said. The business owner said he will see what happens in the next week or two, but he has no definite plans to reopen or a timeline in which to do so. If you think of a movie theater as your in-person alternative to Netflix, it fails. If you think of your theater as your community hub for entertainment that requires a certain level of membership and support, it succeeds. And I don't know how it gets answered. We've tried for a year to sort of explain this, he said. For each theater, it's a little different, he added. The Robinson Theater was acquired by their main lender and is subject to court confirmation around January 15th. The Clinton building will be going to a sheriff's office sale later this month, and the lender will likely be the winning bid to keep control of the property, Gubelman said. The Streeter building is in Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and Gubelman said they asked the court to dismiss the bankruptcy so they can begin the liquidation process. The possibilities for the theaters include adaptive reuse, such as the bank giving them to someone to turn them into storage buildings. Some theater operator will attempt to buy the buildings. Or, if Eagle's current investors' project was back on track tomorrow, then they would have a conversation with the bank. Our customers have kept us going, even as the institutional pro-business organizations have given up, and along the way we asked ourselves, why are we still doing this? Why is it important for us to finish out the year? And it was not some vague love of movies or communities. It was love for our customers, he said. And we stayed open as long as we did to give us the best chance to continue serving those folks. And those are the relationships that we'll miss the most. and some color photos here. Medium-sized one of the interior, the Clintonia Eagle Theater. Concessions counter is pictured after the announcement. The movie theater is now closed in Clinton on Monday, January 5th, 2026. The Streeter Eagle 6 in Streeter and the Eagle Theater in Robinson have also closed. And the counter is blue with a black countertop. And in the center is a glass display case with all of the candy and snack offerings. Shown in the background is a large two-kettle popcorn maker and soda fountain next to it. Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review, photo credit. Another medium-sized photo here. It says, "Sorry, folks, Clintonia Eagle Theater is closed. Thanks for," and that's the number four, "the memories." And there's a sign in the window here. That's a handwritten sign. And finally, an exterior shot. Clintonia Theater is pictured after the announcement that it is now closed. And it's from the parking lot looking at the main entrance. Joseph Ressler, Herald and Review, photo credit. Moving on to page A2 on The Nation, most of Illinois still paying 1% grocery tax. Ben Singson, Jacksonville Journal-Courier, Jacksonville. More than half of Illinoisans, including most in West Central Illinois, will continue paying a tax on groceries that the state stopped collecting in the new year. The state's 1% tax on groceries was discontinued Thursday, more than 2 years after Governor J.B. Pritzker signed off on legislation eliminating it from the state budget. In his 2024 State of the State address, Pritzker said that getting rid of the tax was aimed at helping relieve some of the pressure inflation had been putting on families. "It's one more regressive tax we just don't need," Pritzker said. More than half of all Illinois residents will still be paying that tax at the local level, however. The state allowed municipalities to retain the tax in 2026 via a locally enacted ordinance. Data compiled by Illinois Municipal League indicates that 656 municipalities, holding about 56.4% of the state's population, roughly 7.2 million people, have chosen to establish their own grocery tax, including Jacksonville and numerous West Central Illinois communities. Illinois Municipal League CEO Brad Cole called sales tax revenues a cornerstone of many local budgets across Illinois when explaining why so many places chose to keep the tax. The Jacksonville City Council voted 7-1 in June to keep the tax in place, with Alderman Teresa Heap being the sole holdout. Mayor Andy Ezard previously told the Journal Courier that it made more sense to keep it going than to try and find another way to make up the revenue it would have lost. Some West Central Illinois communities like Winchester, Ashland, and Murrayville have foregone keeping the tax altogether. Other municipalities like Beardstown and Chandlerville have their entities or entries in an Illinois Department of Revenue database of places keeping the tax listed as needing a certified ordinance. Beardstown Mayor Tim Harris said that, to his knowledge, the city already had an ordinance written up by its attorney when it voted in August to enact its own version of the tax. Harris said the city council kept the tax because residents of Beardstown were already used to it being there. Once the city began collecting the tax, the consumer would be treated the same way as they did when the state was the one administering it, which was his primary concern, he said. "I don't believe I've heard one word of protest from anybody," he said. Maduro pleads not guilty to drug trafficking. Michael R. Sisak, Larry Neumeister, and Eric Turner, Associated Press, New York. Nicolas Maduro declared himself the president of my country as he protested his capture and pleaded not guilty Monday to the federal drug trafficking charges that the Trump administration used to justify removing him from power. "I was captured," Maduro said in Spanish as translated by a courtroom reporter before being cut off by the judge. Asked later for his plea to the charges, he stated, "I'm innocent. I'm not guilty. I'm a decent man, the president of my country." The courtroom appearance, Maduro's first since U.S. authorities seized him and his wife from their home. In a middle-of-the-night military operation kickstarts the U.S. government's most consequential prosecution in decades of a foreign head of state. The criminal case in Manhattan is unfolding against the diplomatic backdrop of an audacious U.S.-engineered regime change that President Donald Trump claims will enable his administration to run the South American country. Maduro, wearing a blue jail uniform, was led into court along with his co-defendant wife just before noon for the brief but required legal proceeding. Both put on headsets to hear the English language proceeding as it translated into Spanish. The couple were transported to the Manhattan courthouse under armed guard early Monday from the Brooklyn jail, where they've been detained since arriving in the U.S. on Saturday. A motorcade carrying Maduro left the jail about 7:15 a.m. and made its way to a nearby athletic field, where Maduro slowly made his way to a waiting helicopter. The chopper flew across New York Harbor and landed at a Manhattan heliport, where Maduro, limping, was loaded into an armored vehicle. A few minutes later, the law enforcement caravan was inside a garage at the courthouse complex, just around the corner from the one where Trump was convicted in 2024 of falsifying business records. Across the street from the courthouse, the police separated a small but growing group of protesters from about a dozen pro-intervention demonstrators, including one man who pulled a Venezuelan flag away from those protesting the U.S. action. As a criminal defendant in the U.S. legal system, Maduro will have the same rights as any other person accused of a crime, including the right to a trial by a jury of regular New Yorkers. Maduro's lawyers are expected to contest the legality of his arrest, arguing that he is immune from prosecution as a sovereign head of state. Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega unsuccessfully tried the same defense after the U.S. military captured him in a similar military invasion in 1990, but the U.S. doesn't recognize Maduro as Venezuela's legitimate head of state, particularly after a much-disputed 2024 re-election. Venezuela's new interim president, Delcy Rodriguez, has demanded that the U.S. return Maduro, who long denied involvement in drug trafficking, though late Sunday she also struck a more conciliatory tone in social media posts inviting collaboration with Trump and respectful relations with the U.S. Before his capture, Maduro and his allies claimed U.S. hostility was motivated by lust for Venezuela's rich oil and mineral resources. The U.S. seized Maduro and his wife in a military operation early Saturday, capturing them in their home on a military base. Trump claimed the U.S. would run Venezuela temporarily, but Secretary of State Marco Rubio said Sunday it would not govern the country day-to-day other than enforcing an existing oil quarantine. Trump suggested Sunday he wants to extend American power further in the Western Hemisphere. Speaking aboard Air Force One, he called Colombia's President Gustavo Petro a sick man who likes making cocaine and selling it to the United States, and he's not going to be doing it very long. He called on Venezuela's Rodriguez to provide total access to her country or face consequences. Trump has suggested that removing Maduro would enable more oil to flow out of Venezuela, but oil prices rose a bit more than 1% in Monday morning trading to roughly $58 a barrel. There are uncertainties about how fast oil production can be ramped up in Venezuela after years of neglect and needed investments, as well as questions about governance and oversight of the sector. A 25-page indictment made public Saturday accuses Maduro and others of working with drug cartels to facilitate the shipment of thousands of tons of cocaine into the U.S. They could face life in prison if convicted. Moving on to the local page, A3, public safety, Decatur shooting victim named Decatur. The Decatur man killed by gunfire Saturday night was identified Monday as Jeremy Z. Dandridge. Macon County Coroner Michael D. Burkham said Dandridge, 35, was the victim gunned down in a parking lot in the 200 block of North Church Street around 8:48 p.m. A second gunshot victim, a 23-year-old male who suffered multiple wounds, had arrived at Decatur Memorial Hospital by private vehicle after the shooting, according to the Decatur Police Department. He was being treated for his injuries, and no update on his condition was available Monday. Detectives are continuing their investigations after interviewing witnesses, collecting evidence, and accessing local surveillance camera videos. Lieutenant Adam Jarrus with the Police Department's Criminal Investigations Division has asked for the public's help. Anyone with information can reach detectives at 217-424-2734 or call Crime Stoppers at 217-423-8477. Gun and drug charges filed, Decatur. Police responding to reports of suspicious people on a Decatur street wound up making three arrests and seizing a rifle. Sergeant Adam Seifman with the Decatur Police Department said patrol officers had been called to the 1200 block of East Leafland Avenue just before 1 a.m. Sunday. As they get there, they observe a vehicle leaving the area with the lights off, Seifman said. So they conduct a traffic stop, and one person tried to get out and walk away. He was detained. And when officers made contact with two other males inside the car, they found a rifle in plain view. The 19-year-old male, who tried to walk away from the vehicle, was arrested on a charge of armed violence concerning the rifle. The other two men, a driver aged 21 and 22-year-old passenger, were booked on charges alleging the unlawful possession of cannabis. Here's an interesting one. Coles County. There's a photo of a small single-engine airplane in a cornfield. A Piper PA-22-108 fixed-wing single-engine aircraft sits Sunday morning in a farm field along Lake Road, south of Illinois 16, after the pilot had to make an emergency landing Saturday morning. The aircraft was still in the field Monday morning as preparations were being made for its removal. And there it is, just sitting in the field near a drainage ditch, which is next to a road, with a vehicle on the road. And Rob Stroud, GGTC, neighbor gives lift to stranded pilot. She spotted emergency landing in Mattoon Field. This article's by Rob Stroud, Mattoon. Lake Road resident Megan Janes was looking out her window Saturday morning when she saw something unusual, a small airplane flying just above the farm field across the road. James stepped outside to investigate and saw that the fixed-wing single-engine aircraft had made an emergency landing in this field just south of Illinois 16 West Marshall Avenue. She then drove to the landing site to make sure the pilot was all right. "He was much more calm than I would have been," James said of the pilot, who was uninjured. Coles County Memorial Airport manager Andrew Fearn said the Piper PA-22-108 was piloted by Stu Moment of Urbana, who has extensive flight experience as an airshow pilot. A 13-minute aerobatics performance by Moment was on the schedule for a 2002 show at this airport. Moment's LinkedIn page reports that he was chief executive officer of the Urbana-based Sublogic Corp when it developed what became Microsoft Flight Simulator. Sublogic's Wikipedia page reports it was formed in 1977 by Bruce Artwick and incorporated in 1978 by Artwick's partner, Stu Moment. Eli's Software Encyclopedia reports Moment is a vital but often under-recognized figure in the early history of computer flight simulation. Along with Bruce Artwick, he co-founded Sublogic Corp., the company that played a foundational role in the development of consumer flight simulators. The Federal Aviation Administration's registry lists the Piper, built in 1961, as being owned by Sublogic. For someone to land like that in a field with no engine and no injuries, they would have to be a good pilot, Fearn said of Moment's flying skills. After checking on Moment, Jane said they talked while she drove him to the Coles County Memorial Airport, and she got to hear him report the emergency landing to the Federal Aviation Administration. Jane said Moment recounted that the airplane's engine seized up while he was heading to Missouri. She said Moment was unable to reach the Coles County Memorial Airport, so he decided to use the Bear Farm Field as an emergency landing site. She said the landing was relatively smooth. He said if the field had not been partially frozen, he would have rolled several times, Jane said of the aircraft. "I was thankful he was not hurt, and he had a place to put the airplane down." Monday morning, the airplane was still in the field on the east side of Lake Road. Fearn said Moment's hauling service hopes to get the aircraft out of the field before forecasted rainfall. He noted that the wings will need to be removed first. While the airplane will soon leave her rural neighborhood, Janes will retain some vivid memories of its emergency landing. "It was definitely an unusual Saturday for sure. Not our typical activity around here," Jane said. Moving on to the nation and world, it's the E-Edition Plus. Washington, D.C. CDC U.S. drops vaccine advice. Medical professionals say change will lead to confusion and disease. Articles by Ali Swenson and Lauren Nierengard, Associated Press. Washington. The U.S. took an unprecedented step Monday of dropping the number of vaccines it recommends for every child, cutting protection against a half dozen diseases in a move slammed by the nation's pediatricians. The overhaul is effective immediately, meaning the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention will now recommend vaccines against 11 diseases. What's no longer broadly recommended is protection against flu, rotavirus, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, some forms of meningitis or RSV. Instead, protections against those diseases are only recommended for certain groups deemed high risk or if their doctors recommend them in what's called shared decision making. Trump administration officials said the overhaul, a move long sought by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., won't result in families who want the vaccines losing access to them, and said insurance will continue to pay. But medical experts said the move increases confusion for parents and could increase preventable diseases. The change came after President Donald Trump asked the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in December to review how peer nations approach vaccine recommendations and consider revising its guidance to align with theirs. HHS said its comparison to 20 peer nations found that the U.S. was an outlier in both the number of vaccinations and the number of doses it recommends to all children. Officials with the agency framed the change as a way to increase public trust by recommending only the most important vaccinations for children to receive. Among those left on the recommended for everyone list are measles, whooping cough, polio, tetanus, chickenpox, and HPV. Medical experts said the change without public discussion or a transparent review of the data would put children at risk. Dr. Sean O'Leary of the American Academy of Pediatrics said countries carefully consider vaccine recommendations based on levels of disease in their populations and their health systems. You can't just copy and paste public health, and that's what they seem to be doing here, said O'Leary. Literally, children's health and children's lives are at stake. The decision was made without input from an advisory committee that typically consults on the vaccine schedule, said senior officials at HHS, who spoke on the condition of anonymity. CPB leaders vote to shutter agency. Leaders of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private agency that steered federal funding to PBS, NPR, and hundreds of public television and radio stations across the country, voted Monday to dissolve the organization that was created in 1967. CPB had been winding down since Congress acted last summer to defund its operations at the encouragement of President Donald Trump. Its board of directors chose Monday to shutter CPB completely instead of keeping it in existence as a shell. CPB's final act would be to protect the integrity of the public media system and the democratic values by dissolving, rather than allowing the organization to remain defunded and vulnerable to additional attacks, said Patricia Harrison, the organization's president and CEO. Judge allows sharing of some Medicaid info. New York, the nation's health department, was able to resume sharing the personal data of certain Medicaid enrollees with deportation officials starting Monday, according to a federal judge's ruling, in a blow to states that sued the administration over privacy concerns. But the judge's decision, issued December 29, strictly limits the scope of the data from the 22 plaintiff states that can be shared, for now allowing the agency to hand over only basic biographical information about immigrants living in the United States illegally. The ruling from the U.S. District Judge Vince Chhabria in San Francisco comes after the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services said it planned to share the data again as part of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown. Walz drops bid for a third term. Klobuchar considers entering the race, says source close to Senator. Steve Karnowski and Bill Barrow, Associated Press, St. Paul, Minnesota. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, Democrats' 2024 candidate for vice president, ended his bid for a third gubernatorial term Monday amid President Donald Trump's relentless focus on a fraud investigation into the state's child care programs and its Somali community. With less than four months after announcing his reelection campaign, Walz said negative attention and Republican attacks contributed to an extraordinarily difficult year for our state, making it impossible for him to serve full time as governor while also being a candidate to keep his job. Every minute that I spend defending my own political interest would be a minute I can't spend defending the people of Minnesota against the criminals who prey on our generosity and the cynics who want to prey on our differences, Walz said at the state capitol. So I've decided to step out of this race, and I'll let others worry about the election while I focus on the work that's in front of me for the next year. Walz did not take questions from reporters after speaking for about 7 minutes. Donald Trump and his allies in Washington, in St. Paul, and online want to make our state a colder, meaner place, Walz said, referring to the Trump administration, without funds for the programs and the Republican president's attacks on Somali immigrants in Minnesota. Trump wrote on social media that Waltz was not running because he was caught red-handed with stealing tens of billions of taxpayer dollars, an accusation against the governor that lacks evidence despite widely acknowledged fraud problems. Waltz's exit scrambles the contest in a Democrat-leaning state that Republicans insist they can win. Democrats hold 24 of the 50 governor's seats nationwide, with 36 seats, including Minnesota's, on the ballot this year. Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar is considering entering the Minnesota race, according to a person close to her. The person, who spoke on the condition of anonymity, said the senator who ran for president in 2020 has not made a final decision. About a dozen Republicans are already running. They include MyPillow founder and chief executive Mike Lindell, an election denier who is close to Trump. Officials say worst of flu season still to come. Frequently reported virus type historically dangerous for elderly. Associated Press, New York. U.S. flu infection surged over the holidays, and health officials are calling it a severe season that is likely to get worse. New government data posted Monday for flu activity through the week of Christmas showed that by some measures, this season is already surpassing the flu epidemic of last winter, one of the harshest in recent history. The data was released the same day that the Trump administration said it will no longer recommend flu shots and some other types of vaccines for all children. 43 states reported high or very high flu activity during the week of Christmas, up from 30 states the week before. The higher number appeared to be driven by the type of flu that's been spreading, public health experts say. One type of flu virus called AH3N2 historically has caused the most hospitalizations and deaths in older people. So far this season, that's the type most frequently reported. Even more concerning, more than 90% of the H3N2 infections analyzed were a new version, known as the subclade K variant, that differs from the strain that's in this year's flu shots. And briefly, Ukraine war. President Volodymyr Zelensky replaced the head of Ukraine's security service Monday, continuing a top-level reshuffle ahead of a trip to Paris, where he hoped to finalize agreements with allies on how to ensure that Russia doesn't repeat its invasion if a peace agreement is signed. Drinking water. The Environmental Protection Agency said Monday it would propose a drinking water limit for perchlorate, a chemical in rockets and other explosives, but also said doing so wouldn't significantly benefit public health and that it acted only because a court ordered it. And with that, we come to the end of the first half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review for Tuesday, January 6, 2026. We'll take a short break and return with the second half hour.